Welcome to NACE Clinical Highlights. I'm Dr. Greg Sherman, Chief Medical Officer for NACE. Joining me today for a discussion on the management of insomnia and the role of orexin is Dr. Paul Dagramji. Paul is the Senior Family Practice Physician at Collegeville Family Practice and the Medical Director of Health Services at Ursinus College, both in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. He is past co-chair for the National Sleep Foundation's Sleep and Health Safety course and is on the board of directors of the National Sleep Foundation. Paul is a true thought leader in insomnia, and I'm excited to spend a few minutes with him to hear insights on how to do a better job managing our patients with insomnia, and particularly the role of orexin. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Greg. Glad to be here.
I'm glad you could be here as well. So, Paul, you know as well as I do that primary care clinicians are really on the front line of managing patients with sleep disorders, yet developing a truly effective and sustainable plan for our patients can be really challenging. There are lots of medications on the market, but the newest class of medications available to help us manage insomnia are the orexins. And I think that's an area that requires a little bit more education because I think it's confusing to many of us. I was hoping in our talk today, you could talk to us a little bit about how orexin actually works to manage the sleep-wake cycle, as it's something, as I said, many of us are not that familiar with.
Yeah, sure, Greg. So orexin is a neurotransmitter that is put out by the orexin nuclei. Actually, interestingly, the orexin nucleus, which is located in the hypothalamus, was discovered in the late 1990s by two different laboratories, one of which called it orexin because they were doing some research on satiety and appetite, and they thought that this nucleus had something to do with appetite. Another group that discovered this very similarly at the same time, they called it hypocretin because it's in the hypothalamus. But the name orexin has stuck. And now orexin, as research has shown, is a neurotransmitter whose neurons have far-reaching effects throughout the brain. And orexin seems to be a wake-promoting neurotransmitter. So wherever orexin is active, there is wakefulness. Or arousal, as we say. So as a result of this research, there has been maybe some interest, therefore, in wake and sleep using the orexin neurotransmitter. The interesting thing about orexin, by the way, is that there is a condition where there is little to no orexin in the brain as a result of generally autoimmune destruction of the orexin nucleus. And that condition, Greg, is called narcolepsy. So we clearly can see with narcolepsy, at least, that orexin is really needed for wakefulness and the absence of which causes a substantial amount of drowsiness.
Fascinating. So given all that information, there are now actually medications on the market. One has been on the market for a while and one has recently been approved. And since many of us are not all that familiar with it, maybe you could talk about the data that came out to support these new medications and what our colleagues might expect if they choose to use that for their patients where they think it's appropriate.
Yeah, sure. So I should say that the reason why interest has been generated in this whole orexin pathway is because the research suggested that if we suppress orexin, we may decrease wakefulness and as a result, increase drowsiness and promote sleep. And we do find that the brain has two different sides to it, one side that is involved in wake promotion and the other side that's involved in sleep promotion. And these two don't work at the same time. So when orexin is active, the brain is in wide awake mode. When orexin is inactive and the sleep mode is working, you're in sleep mode. So researchers have thought that perhaps if we can suppress orexin, we can have the sleep mode of the brain become more active, leading to better sleep. So the two medications that have come out, the first one came out called suorexant about 6 years ago. It's a medication that's been indicated for helping people get to sleep and stay asleep by suppressing orexin. And just recently, this year, another medication, lemborexant, has come out. And that medication also indicated for sleep initiation and sleep maintenance, again, by suppressing orexin. So you suppress wakefulness, you allow for the brain's natural and normal abilities of sleep to shine through, helping for the patient to have a better night's sleep.
So if I understand correctly about these medicines, they suppress it by actually blocking the orexin receptors. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. By suppressing orexin, suppressing the orexin receptors, or by antagonizing the orexin receptors, the orexin activity is reduced. And what is orexin activity? It's wakefulness. So we reduce wakefulness, we increase sleep drive as a result of it.
So is there any way that you could create an orexin-like molecule to treat patients that have narcolepsy who are genetically devoid of orexin?
Absolutely. The studies are right now in order to try to find an orexin receptor agonist to help with patients with narcolepsy. Those researchers are now finding that medications in that area may be quite exciting in the near future.
So you think these new orexin molecules offer us advantages over older medications in terms of their efficacy and impact on our patients that we might think about when choosing the next treatment for our patient?
Well, just think about this for a second. All other medications for insomnia, or the majority of them, are tranquilizers. They work on the GABA receptors to increase one's drowsiness, okay? But this medication doesn't increase drowsiness per se. It decreases wakefulness to allow for one's normal sleep drive to be more apparent in the individual. So it's just a different way of improving one's ability to get to sleep and stay asleep, a different way.
As we're thinking about this particular class of drugs, since they're so different, are there any particular side effects or contraindications that people should be aware of when considering them for their patients?
Well, as we know, every medication can potentially have some side effects. Before I say that, though, one of the interesting features about these orexin receptor antagonists is that they have relatively long-term studies, and the studies show that there's no tolerance with these medications. That is, you don't have to take more of the medication in order for it to have the same effect. What we're also noticing is something which we have unfortunately seen with the benzodiazepines, the most common sleep medications. The benzodiazepines have something which is called rebound insomnia, which means when you stop the medicine for a period of time, several days up to a week, the patient can have worse insomnia than when they first started. And that's one of the reasons why, by the way, a lot of patients taking medications like Zaloplan, Zolpidem, Esopiclone, Temazepam, these are benzodiazepine-type medications, they don't like to go off the medication because they sleep terribly for the first several nights and up to a week that they stop the medication. These new medications, the orexin receptor antagonists, are found not to have rebound insomnia. Lemborexant, for example, even after 1 year use, when patients stopped the medication, they found no rebound insomnia. So these are some really interesting features that are positives about it. Now, the medications can both have certain drawbacks. So, for example, neither one of these medications, lemborexant or suvorexant, can be used for narcolepsy for the obvious reason that they're both in the orexin areas. Both of these medications can have somnolence, as all sleep medications do, somnolence the next day. And there's maybe some headache and some nausea and some other respiratory symptoms that can occur as side effects. But the great majority of the side effects that occur, not that often, but nonetheless they do occur, is somnolence in these patients.
Recently, I was reading about some information coming out on Alzheimer's disease that piqued my interest as I learned some more about the orexin system. Can you shed any light on the research that's going on to the Alzheimer's brain and insomnia and how this whole system may be impacted?
Well, what we know about insomnia, first of all, I should say, I thought you were going to ask me that medications have come out in the benzodiazepine category, or studies rather, that show that they may increase the probability of Alzheimer's disease. And as a result, benzodiazepines are now getting less of a favor in treating patients with insomnia. Do orexin receptor antagonists have this kind of a fear? Probably not. Now, as far as orexin and Alzheimer's in general, there is some interesting research about it, that there is less Alzheimer's disease possibly when patients have better sleep. So if there's better sleep, it may translate to a healthier brain. In fact, I think that this sort of speaks of sleep in general, where we know that people who sleep better are generally healthier. We need sleep for our what I call 4 R's: rest, restore, rejuvenate, and repair. And when there's better sleep, there's better health. And that applies not just to the central nervous system, but to the whole body.
Yeah, I certainly know. I feel a whole lot better after a good night's sleep than a lousy one. So I'm all in favor of that. I want to let our listeners know that you can access an enduring CME activity on insomnia and the role of orexin at our website, naceonline.com, as well as the social media platform Figure One or figureone.com, and you can learn more about what Paul and I are discussing today. You can access this and many other programs we have developed on other topics as well. You can also register for one or more of the live conferences we produce every year. If you're on Facebook, please like us, and we will be able to share more educational content and information with you. So, Paul, we talked about the orexins already as the new kid on the block, and you mentioned about benzodiazepines and some of the pros and cons and some different medications. But really, individualizing therapy for our patient that walks in the door and complains of having difficulty sleeping, falling asleep, staying asleep, or just being tired can really be challenging, including, you know, all the different drugs that are available on the market. There's also a whole slew of non-pharmacologic approaches, and many patients really are looking for something that some goals and treatments before they get onto a medication. Can you discuss how you talk about the non-pharmacologic approach in your practice with your patients that some of our colleagues listening can translate into their own practice?
Sure. You know, Greg, one of the reasons why primary care providers are so well suited to treat insomnia is because we are people who discuss things with our patients. We are good at it. We are good at explaining things. We are good at mobilizing a patient's own innate abilities to be healthier. And with sleep, educating them about sleep is the first step in having them sleep better. What's sleep for? Why is sleep important? Why am I here trying to encourage you to have the best night's sleep? As I said, you know, the four R's: rest, restore, rejuvenate, and repair. But after you educate them, then you go into good sleep practices. You know, a lot of patients don't know that the most important part of a good night's sleep is when you wake up, setting the time that you wake up as being constant. That way the brain knows when you should go to sleep. If you tell the brain when you're going to wake up, it'll tell you when you should fall asleep. So then you listen to when your brain becomes drowsy and you fall asleep at that time. But we also advise our patients to keep the hour or two before going to bed as being sleep friendly. Sleep friendly means that you do things that are conducive to sleep. So we don't want to do things like arguing and yelling or exercising or eating a lot or drinking a lot. We don't want to be in front of TV where a light goes into our eyes and tells our brain to stay awake. We don't want to practice these things. Rather, we want to do things that are more sleep friendly. We want to be in a darker, quieter kind of a room and doing things that don't have to do with TVs and TV screens, maybe reading a book or so. And as a result, allow that natural ability of our brain's sleep part to allow us to go into sleep better. So informing our patients about the importance of sleep, giving them good sleep hygiene practices are the first place to start in helping our patients towards a better night's sleep.
So what about the patients that are waking up in the middle of the night and can't fall back to sleep? What are your go-to recommendations for them before other treatments?
Well, the first thing we want to do with patients that wake up in the middle of the night and can't fall back to sleep again is to say, get up out of your bed and sit in a chair close to your bed or somewhere in the room or maybe even outside the room. Don't associate being awake with being in bed. When you get up out of bed, do something which is distracting, something sleep friendly. You probably will wake up in the middle of the night worrying and ruminating and contemplating about your day. Let's make you not do that. Let's not have your wake promoting part of your brain become active. Rather, go into a chair, go into another room maybe, into a chair and start reading something that's relatively sleep friendly, maybe a magazine, maybe a book. And when your natural sleepiness comes back again, go back into bed and you should be able to fall asleep. That's the best recommendation that we give for our patients that wake up in the middle of the night that have trouble falling back to sleep again.
I want to switch gears a little bit because actually treating patients is challenging. And so, Paul, all those behavioral clues are really important, but many of our patients will ultimately need some sort of treatment. And I've heard you give lectures for at least an hour or more on actual pharmacotherapy, but I wonder in this discussion with me today, there's any key points that you can share with our colleagues on how to make some individualized choices of pharmacotherapy for their patients as they're presenting with complaints that may not have responded adequately to cognitive behavioral therapy or other modifications that we may have recommended? What are your thoughts on that?
Sure, Greg. You know, just like many other conditions that we treat, it's not just one medicine and that's it. And there's a tendency in primary care to just have one sleep medication and that's it. And that doesn't make sense. We have to be a little bit more sophisticated in treating our patients with insomnia by listening to their symptoms and then discussing with them what medication. Take a look at some of the parameters. One is, does a patient have trouble getting to sleep or staying asleep? Does a patient wake up in the middle of the night with trouble getting back to sleep? Does the patient wake up too early or any combination thereof? And different medicines work differently. So for example, in somebody who has trouble getting to sleep only, you want to pick a medication that works quickly and gets out of the system quickly. Those medications could be Zaloplan, and they could be Zolpidem, and they could be Remeltion. These are medications that act quickly and short. If a patient has trouble staying asleep, pick a medication that works in the middle of the night. So for example, low-dose Doxepin would be a good idea for somebody like that, or maybe Esopiclone or Zolpidem extended release. Now, in some patients, they have trouble both getting to sleep and staying asleep. So pick something that works quickly and works effectively through the night. And those medications could be Esopiclone, they could be Zolpidem extended release, but also the suvorexant, which came out 6 years ago, which is a melatonin or orexin receptor antagonist. And the new one now, lemborexant, would be a good choice as well for somebody who has trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep. So we have to be more sophisticated by asking the questions, what kind of insomnia symptoms do you have, in picking which one? But Greg, there's a couple of other factors as well. There are some patients that should have an unscheduled medicine. So there are some medicines that are unscheduled. There are some patients who have respiratory problems as a concern, and there are some medications that affect the respiratory tract a little bit less. And there are patients who want to be able to wake up in the middle of the night and to be able to function. And some medications are better in those areas as well. So we need to be more sophisticated and know which medications fit our patients best.
Paul, do you have any tips on how to safely switch classes of medicines if we started on one and we're not getting the response that the patient is desiring, to pick another one and transition?
It's not unusual for patients to not do well with a particular sleep medicine for a number of reasons. Either it doesn't work well, or they have some side effects from it. They don't like how they feel. Maybe they even have a hangover effect. There's a tendency for us to start our patients on benzodiazepines initially. And when patients fail the first medication, like a benzodiazepine, the best way to switch them to another medication, now I should say that there are very few to no clinical trials that tell us exactly what to do, but probably the best thing to do, especially in a patient who's been taking a benzodiazepine type medicine for a long time, is wean them off of that medication. If they've been on it 6 months, a year, several years or so, you tell your patient, I'm going to wean you off this medicine and see if I can get you to another medicine that might be a little bit better for you, better suited for you. So you wean them off very slowly, and then you give them a couple of days without sleep medicine. Why is that? Because it's possible that they have outgrown their need for a sleeping pill. So the first thing that you do in a patient that you want to switch off is to have them stop the medicine completely. And if they are continuing with their insomnia, perfectly fine, go to the next medication at the proper initiation dose.
So you wouldn't consider weaning one down and weaning one up at the same time? You feel pretty strongly that they should be weaned off one before initiating anything new?
Too many advantages to weaning somebody off completely. Again, one of the advantages being that they may not need any medication at all. And secondly, the advantage that when you start the new medication, if any problems occur, you'll know that it's from the new medication only and not because of a combination effect.
Well, Paul, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and share your expertise on how we can more effectively manage our patients with insomnia and really better understand the role of the newest treatment in our toolbox of orexin and where its role might play. So I think you've provided some great information on how we can improve the care that we provide our patients and really truly make a difference in their lives. So thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure, Greg.
If you're interested in learning more about managing insomnia, go to our website at naceonline.com and register for our enduring activities on insomnia or any other program we've developed. Please like us on Facebook at NACME to be part of our online social media community and get access to other content and programs we share. I want to thank you, our audience, for joining us for this podcast. I hope you've learned something new you can bring back to your practice. We look forward to having you join us for other upcoming podcasts in the near future. Thank you so much. Thank you.